From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson. In with our daily collection of popular VOA podcasts. Oh, we like them anyway. Check them out. All in one popular location. Japan's Prime Minister embarking on several interactions with world leaders this week. That's on today's Daybreak Asia. We look at what may be confronting him on his trip. Teacher exchanges help to broaden education opportunities for students and educators alike. That's on this week's Education Report. China Focus with Sarah Williams jumps borders to look at the continuing Fukushima debate with China. Cancer surgery techniques making new strides, as we hear, in the American Cafe with Ira Melman. And continuing with health, now when David Byrd goes to Sweden for diabetes research. All that and more coming up on today's VOA Global. Hi, and welcome back to another edition of Daybreak Asia. If this is your first time with us, this is our summary of Asia news and events today for Wednesday, April 22nd. I'm Jim Stevenson. Among today's headlines, ahead of participation this week in an Asia-Africa summit and a state visit to the United States next week, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe sent a ritual offering Tuesday to a controversial war shrine in Tokyo to mark the traditional spring festival. Such visits have drawn sharp criticism from China and South Korea. The Japanese leader will take part in a two-day Africa-Asia summit in Jakarta, where his brief remarks will be watched closely regarding Japan's past and future. China's President Xi Jinping will be among the world leaders attending. Michael Kuchek, adjunct fellow at Tokyo's Temple University, expects Mr. Abe to reaffirm Japan's intention to remain a positive force in the world. And he says it's likely Mr. Abe and President Xi will meet on the sidelines of the Jakarta summit.
Xi Jinping and President Park of South Korea had a significantly good chance that Mr. Abe would not be in office much longer than a year. That's how long most Japanese prime ministers last. However, over 2 years in office, there are no rivals within the party. Japanese opposition parties are moribund, and they simply cannot mount any kind of challenge toward Mr. Abe in a political way. He's going to be around for several years, at which point the leaders of South Korea, but more importantly, Mr. Xi Jinping of China, have got to come to some kind of decision, and I think they have come to it, that they're going to have to interact with and deal with Mr. Abe. And once Xi Jinping deals with Mr. Abe, then President Park of South Korea can take that as a signal, and she herself can make the political decision to approach him, despite the fact relations between South Korea and Japan are just terribly fraught.
What about the Washington trip? What message will he be sending?
He'll be very careful to appeal to the United States, particularly in regards to the construction of a Futenma replacement facility in the Bay of Henoko. That has been a very difficult and long-term process that Japan has been interested in for a very, very long time, and the United States has had as a primary goal in the Japan-U.S. relationship. He'll have nice things to say about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, even though this morning at 4 a.m. when talks broke off, nothing still had been decided. In terms of the Japan-U.S. military alliance, he has a large number of promises regarding increasing Japan's ability to participate in collective self-defense. However, the legislation needed to realize that has not been passed yet, so Mr. Abe is actually premature in his address to Congress. So he comes with a lot of promises on his lips, but his hands are pretty much empty. But they're nice promises, and they're ones that the United States has wanted to hear for a very long time.
Mr. Abe's U.S. visit, including meetings with President Obama and an address to a joint meeting of Congress, will highlight the bilateral security alliance, new defense guidelines, and progress on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani on Tuesday swore in 16 new members of his cabinet whose nominations were endorsed by the parliament last week. The so-called National Unity Government now has a nearly complete cabinet, barring the defense minister 7 months into its term. The political advancement has raised hopes of improvement in governance and better management of security and economic troubles facing Afghanistan. We hear more now from Ayaz Ghul.
The swearing-in ceremony at Kabul's presidential palace followed Saturday's mandatory parliamentary endorsement of all new cabinet members, including four women. The swift approval by the parliament surprised many because the first such vote of confidence in late January saw lawmakers approving only a third of the ministers President Ashraf Ghani nominated to form a 25-member cabinet. Dual nationality, allegations of involvement in crimes, and lack of higher education were cited among the causes. But insurgent attacks around the country have increased and economic troubles have deepened in the wake of international military withdrawal and dwindling financial assistance. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
A United Nations conference on the illegal trade in synthetic drugs says trafficking is growing across much of Southeast Asia, aided by the internet and rising demand. Ron Corbin reports for VOA from Bangkok that authorities are calling for tighter controls on the drug's precursor chemicals.
The UN Office on Drugs and Crime, UNODC, says in East and Southeast Asia, drug production and trafficking is expanding and diversifying, driven by new synthetic drugs outside international control. The UNODC says there is a growing need to prevent legal chemicals from being diverted into drug production. Jeremy Douglas, regional representative for the UNODC in Asia, in an address to more than 200 senior government officials from 39 countries Tuesday, said the region's drug problem has gotten worse.
And it is important that this conference is here in Asia, where most of the precursor chemicals are produced. If we are to make headway, we need to have effective international control.
In Southeast Asia, authorities say Myanmar, also known as Burma, is the region's largest producer of synthetic drugs, with smugglers trafficking precursor chemicals into the country and then transporting the drugs back across the country's porous borders to markets in China, Thailand, and beyond. Thailand's Justice Minister, Paibun Kumchaya, says despite concerns over synthetic drugs, there appears to have been little recent progress in controlling precursor chemicals in the region.
In the year 2013, we raised awareness of all the countries, but we have not come up with the clear measure yet of how the manufacturing countries, importing countries, and all the relevant parties, how are we going to control precursor chemicals effectively in our region?
UN drug law enforcement officials say there are hundreds of synthetic drugs known as new psychoactive substances, NPS, but just 10 have been listed as controlled substances regulating their sale. That means that many criminal syndicates use the internet to market the drugs online, posing a challenge for law enforcement. UNODC's Douglas told VOA more domestic controls are needed to control trafficking of precursors in the region.
This is the heartland or the center point. Production Asia is where the precursors are largely coming from.
Officials meeting in Bangkok are trying to develop a regional policy for dealing with the problem, as well as tighter border controls. The policy plans are being prepared for the 2016 United Nations General Assembly special session on the worldwide drug trafficking problem. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia is a weekday feature of VOA. At voanews.com, we have these and many more stories from Asia. Check them out and look for our free Daybreak Asia podcast.
We value what you think, and we love to look at the comments that you leave for us on the stories that we post at our website, voanews.com. One of the stories we had, and you just heard on Daybreak Asia, Pakistan seeking to alleviate China's concerns on terrorism as President Xi Jinping wrapped up his two-day trip to the South Asian country. While the two countries focused on China's projected $46 billion of investment and loans to develop an economic corridor through Pakistan, terrorism and militancy also featured heavily in their discussions. Sam wrote to us, he said, why China is the only country among the major ones largely unaffected by terrorism? So from China replied, self-burning cases in Tibet, Qinghai province, and the killing case in Yunnan province, I don't know why you say that. At the same time, we're confronting splitting from Tibet, Xinjiang, and Hong Kong. Another story on our website, rising tensions over the conflict in Yemen appear to be pitting the United States against Iran in a sensitive showdown in the Gulf of Aden, citing current instability and the need to ensure that vital shipping lanes in the area remain open. U.S. naval officials said that they're sending two more ships to the waters off the coast of Yemen to take part in maritime security operations. Robert Milton writes, excellent article. Iran should understand actions in support of terrorism could dampen the peace talks that have been on the move. Such actions create dangers and threats to Saudi Arabia. Iran's actions are a proxy for declaring war in the region, and he goes on to say, will Saudi sit idly by watching its neighbor collapsing? Igor from Russia says the focus to make sure that we have sufficient forces in the area to counter any threats. In fact, U.S. ships are there to show support for the outgoing regime in Yemen. Whatever your opinion, you can leave them with us at voanews.com. We'll love to read them. This is VOA Global from the Voice of America. Beyond our website, we have many other ways for you to follow us. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Weibo. Just log on and check it out. Especially our Facebook page, which we're rather proud of, VOA Asia Facebook, where you can find many of the stories that we've posted on our website, a lot of other special things that we put up there each and every day. And we hope that, as always, when you visit, you'll like us.
I'm Ira Melman with Report on Education. The U.S. Department of Education has developed a strategy designed to globalize education in this country. Quite a few companies are involved in attempts to achieve that goal. Some make use of a State Department document designed to facilitate cultural exchange. One of these companies is VF International Education in North Carolina. I spoke with Jeff Seeby, an international education advisor for the company that has set up a system to, among other things, bring foreign teachers to the United States to teach.
We've had over 10,000 teachers from more than 50 countries take part as an exchange teacher in our program. Our program's been around for more than 25 years.
How much does this cost to apply for this visa and apply for your company's services? And is there any pay involved once the teachers get here?
VIF doesn't charge any fees to the teachers. We're funded by the school systems that we work with. So it's free to apply to VIF, free to become a VIF teacher.
Now, what about pay once they get here?
Once we've decided that they've been accepted into our program and that we've lined up a spot for them at a school, then we take care of the visa, and we handle that. The fees that the schools pay cover the visa costs, so it's not on the teacher. So the teacher is paid like an American teacher that they work alongside based on the number of years of experience that they have.
How does someone apply for this? If I'm sitting there in China, I am a teacher or I have teaching credentials, I want to come to the United States and teach, walk me step by step through what I have to do.
You go to our website, vifprogram.com, and there's a big button on the front page that says apply, and you can apply. The first part is a very quick application, and it's really just to make sure you meet the minimum requirements. Those are that you have full-time teaching experience in the grades that we're looking for, so kindergarten through to grade 12, so working with 5 to 18-year-olds, that you have a teaching degree or diploma that's equivalent to a U.S. bachelor's in education. And then a few other things that we'll go through in that part, and you submit a quick application. If everything looks good, then we'll send you the full online application to fill out. And you go through a series of interviews. One, we do mostly by Skype interviews now to start. And if you pass that, then we do in-person interviews in various locations. The one main one for Asia is in Beijing.
I take it there are language requirements here.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to be fluent in English, no matter what subject or language you're teaching, and then obviously in the target language. So if you're going to be a Chinese immersion teacher, then you have to be fluent in Chinese. And we also have Spanish and other subjects. So it's fluency in English and the target language.
What areas will the teachers work in? Where will they be geographically in the United States?
So for over 25 years, we've been working in the state of North Carolina. So that's the place that we have more schools involved and most of our teachers there. But we also have some in the neighboring states, so in South Carolina and in Virginia.
How effective are these teachers when they teach in the United States?
These teachers are very effective, and we look at that in many different ways when we go and observe our teachers and we rate them on scales and things. But the one that people are often most concerned about is how their students perform. And in a recent study done by the University of North Carolina, they looked at the students that were taught by our teachers and that were taught by other programs like Teach for America and by just teachers that were trained in the state. And our teachers performed equally or better in many different areas.
Jeff Seeby, an international education advisor for VF International in North Carolina. You can hear Report on Education weekly at voanews.com and many podcast platforms.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe sent a ritual offering Tuesday to a controversial war shrine in Tokyo to mark the traditional spring festival. It's a sign Mr. Abe will likely not pay a visit to the Yasukuni Shrine. Such visits have drawn sharp criticism from China and South Korea. The state-run China Daily Tuesday said Mr. Abe's bold move has shown he never truly apologized for the Asian people's sufferings brought by the Japanese army during the past war. The Japanese leader will take part in a two-day Africa-Asia summit in Jakarta. Yuichiro Sato, a security analyst at Japan's Ritsumeikan Asia-Pacific University, tells VOA's Victor Beatty Mr. Abe's decision to donate a masakaki tree was a clever tactic ahead of Wednesday's shrine visit by other Japanese politicians.
Abe can obviously not join this group, but by not joining, Abe actually domestically lose the political score. That's his dilemma. He cannot go to the shrine for now, but he cannot admit that he's refraining.
What do you anticipate Mr. Abe's remarks will be to the Asia-Africa summit in Jakarta?
The talking about future actually is what exactly Japan's going to do, because you know Japan has played a very active role in, for example, African summit and the development agenda that Japan has been supporting for the last decade. So in that sense, the talk will be very future-oriented, and China is probably not going to try to use this forum to bring up the historical issues and feature the 70-year anniversary of the end of the World War II. I think this summit meeting in Jakarta will be somewhat of a cordial, but not much of a concrete substance.
Michael Kuchek, adjunct fellow at Tokyo's Temple University, says it's likely Mr. Abe and Chinese President Xi Jinping will meet on the sidelines of the Jakarta summit.
Xi Jinping and President Park of South Korea had a significantly good chance that Mr. Abe would not be in office much longer than a year. That's how long most Japanese prime ministers last. However, over 2 years in office, there are no rivals within the party. Japanese opposition parties are moribund, and they simply cannot mount any kind of challenge toward Mr. Abe in a political way. He's going to be around for several years, at which point the leaders of South Korea, but more importantly, Mr. Xi Jinping of China, have got to come to some kind of decision, and I think they have come to it, that they're going to have to interact with and deal with Mr. Abe. And once Xi Jinping deals with Mr. Abe, then President Park of South Korea can take that as a signal, and she herself can make the political decision to approach him, despite the fact relations between South Korea and Japan are just terribly fraught.
What about the Washington trip? What message will he be sending?
He'll be very careful to appeal to the United States, particularly in regards to the construction of a Futenma replacement facility in the Bay of Henoko. That has been a very difficult and long-term process that Japan has been interested in for a very, very long time, and the United States has had as a primary goal in the Japan U.S. relationship. He'll have nice things to say about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, even though this morning at 4 a.m. when talks broke off, nothing still had been decided. More progress had been made, but the Trans-Pacific Partnership is still not yet ready to be unveiled. And finally, in terms of the Japan-U.S. military alliance, he has a large number of promises regarding increasing Japan's ability to participate in collective self-defense, which is when the United States is attacked, Japan will come to its aid under certain very limited circumstances. However, the legislation needed to realize that has not been passed yet, so Mr. Abe is actually premature in his address to Congress. So he comes with a lot of promises on his lips, but his hands are pretty much empty. But they're nice promises, and they're ones that the United States has wanted to hear for a very long time.
Mr. Abe travels to the U.S. next week for meetings with President Obama and an address to a joint session of Congress. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
From the Voice of America, this is Asia Business News. I'm Jim Stevenson. Japanese stocks rose Tuesday as hopes for strong corporate earnings buoyed by major automakers and electronic manufacturers. The Nikkei benchmark closed up 1.4% to finish at 19909. Toyota Motor Corporation and Nissan Motor Corporation gained 2.2% and 2.4% respectively, while Panasonic gained 3.7%. Hong Kong stocks posted their biggest daily gain in 2 weeks Tuesday on signs that investors in mainland China are keen to plow more money into the city's markets, hunting for bargains. The official Shanghai Securities Journal reported that trust companies on the Chinese mainland are flooding into the Hong Kong stock market and are facing a shortage of overseas investment quotas. The Hang Seng Index jumped 2.8% to finish at 27,850, while the China Enterprises Index gained 3%. It now sits at 14,531. Aberdeen Asset Management's head of Asian operations warned Tuesday that Chinese money was moving a bit like a casino in domestic stock markets, while BlackRock called on China to reform its capital markets to further avert boom and bust scenarios. China stocks have jumped nearly 80% since November to trade near seven-year highs. On Monday, Shanghai Stock Exchange trade surpassed the 1 trillion yuan or $161 billion mark for the first time, making the bourse the world's biggest in terms of turnover ahead of the New York Stock Exchange. Recent strong gains have come despite stretched valuations, prompting a warning from the official Xinhua News Agency late on Monday against irrational exuberance. That's a look at Asia business news from the Voice of America.
This is Today in History. On April 22, 1889, at exactly noon, cannons were fired to signal thousands of would-be settlers to make a mad dash into the newly opened Oklahoma Territory, previously known as Indian Territory. The Oklahoma land rush was an extraordinary display of American pioneer spirit, but also a sad example of the gradual loss of Indian lands. In 1864, the U.S. Congress passed the Coinage Act that mandated that the inscription, "In God We Trust," be placed on all coins minted as United States currency. In 1876, the first National League baseball game was played in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The Boston Red Stockings defeated the Philadelphia Athletics 6-5. In 1912, Pravda, the official publication of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, was published for the first time in St. Petersburg. On this day in 1915, German forces introduced the first major use of poisonous chlorine gas along the Western battlefront during World War I. The French and British would soon retaliate in kind. On this day in 1969, at a concert in Dalton, England, the British rock band The Who debuted their rock opera about a deaf, dumb, and blind boy who becomes a pinball champion. In In 1975, Tommy was made into a movie that was a huge commercial success. Then in 1993, a stage version on Broadway won 5 Tony Awards, including Best Original Score for its creator, Who guitarist Peter Townsend. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Just ahead, Saudi Arabia explains why it is ending a campaign of airstrikes on Houthi rebels in Yemen. We'll find out how China and South Korea reacted to Japan's leader sending an offering to a controversial war shrine. And we'll look at a new survey of the 10 most restrictive nations for international media. I'm Michael Lippin. Saudi Arabia says it is ending a campaign of airstrikes by Sunni Gulf nations on Shiite Houthi rebels in Yemen. After 4 weeks of Saudi-led bombings on Houthi targets across Yemen, Saudi officials said Tuesday the rebels no longer pose a threat to Yemeni civilians or neighboring countries, including Saudi Arabia. They said coalition efforts to help Yemen's internationally recognized government to fully restore its power will enter a new phase, focusing on the political process and helping civilians. But Saudi officials also warned that coalition airstrikes could resume at any moment to prevent Houthi militias from moving around Yemen. While Iran welcomed the Saudi announcement of an end to airstrikes as a step forward toward a political settlement, Tehran's critics have accused it of providing weapons to the Houthis. Reports from the Somali capital Mogadishu say a car bomb has exploded outside a popular restaurant in the city, killing at least 7 people. The Reuters news agency quotes a spokesman for Al-Shabaab as saying the militant group was behind Tuesday's lunchtime attack. At least 8 other people were wounded in the blast, which targeted the Banoda restaurant, a spot popular with Somali civil servants and employees at the presidential palace. It was Al-Shabaab's 4th deadly attack in Somalia in as many days. An Egyptian court has sentenced the country's former president, Mohamed Morsi, to 20 years in prison in connection with the deaths of protesters in 2012. In a Tuesday ruling, the court found Mr. Morsi and 12 other members of the Muslim Brotherhood guilty of intimidation and violence, but not murder, meaning the former president escaped a possible death penalty. The charges are related to a 2012 incident in which Mr. Morsi's Islamist supporters attacked anti-Brotherhood activists who were protesting Mr. Morsi's decree declaring that his decisions could not be challenged by the courts. At least 10 people were killed in the ensuing violence. While rights group Amnesty International denounced the sentencing of Mr. Morsi, Egypt's first democratically elected leader, as a travesty of justice. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has made a ritual offering to a controversial shrine honoring the country's war dead. Tuesday's offering sparked a sharp response from China and South Korea, two nations occupied by Japan in the 20th century. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
The Yasukuni Shrine for Japan's war dead includes those convicted as war criminals in the wake of World War II. Personal visits in the past have sparked outrage from Japan's neighbors, but the decision by Prime Minister Abe to stave off a visit and instead send a potted tree as a religious gift was still seen as an irritation. South Korean Foreign Ministry spokesman No Kwang-il said Japanese political leaders should clearly understand that paying their appreciation and respect towards the Yasukuni Shrine is perceived as violating international agreements and harming international stability. China's Foreign Ministry spokesman Hong Lei said China's position on the shrine is clear and consistent. Hong said Prime Minister Abe must earnestly abide by the relevant promises of past cabinets to face up to and reflect on the history of aggression. Prime Minister Abe had been expected to meet with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping on the sidelines of this week's Asia-Africa summit in Indonesia. How much of an impact the offering might have on the proposed meeting is unclear. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
Italian prosecutors say the Tunisian captain of a migrant boat that capsized in the Mediterranean over the weekend mistakenly rammed his vessel into a merchant ship coming to its rescue. The prosecutor said Tuesday the captain steered his dangerously overloaded boat into the Portuguese container ship, causing the boat to capsize off the coast of Libya and drowning hundreds of migrants seeking a better life in Europe. The prosecutors absolved the merchant ship of any responsibility for the tragedy. There were only 28 survivors rescued in what European authorities fear could become the Mediterranean's deadliest migrant disaster. A new survey of global public opinion has found that Russia has earned the lowest approval ratings of all major world powers for the eighth year in a row. The Gallup survey of people in more than 130 countries published on Tuesday showed that Moscow's ranking fell sharply in Western nations after the Russian intervention last year in Ukraine. The survey of about 1,000 adults also showed the United States with the highest ratings, followed by Germany, the European Union, China, and then Russia. The international pollster said the results were similar to those recorded for the last 6 years. The Committee to Protect Journalists has listed the 10 countries where the news media are the most restricted. Led by Eritrea and North Korea, the CPJ report released on Tuesday says these countries harass and imprison journalists, as well as censor the internet to keep reporters quiet. VOA's Daniela Schreier has the details.
Being jailed is what happens to journalists in the 10 countries cited in the CPJ report. China is the report's leading jailer, with 44 journalists behind bars. And the CPJ cites Iran as using mass and arbitrary detention to silence dissent or force exile. With 200 journalists worldwide jailed this year alone, Courtney Ratch of CPJ says it's a perilous time to report.
The past 3 years have been the most dangerous on record for journalists, with record numbers of killings, of imprisonment, and based on CPJ's assistance data, more than 400 journalists who have been forced into exile over the past 5 years.
Internet censorship is a key weapon to stifle criticism. In North Korea, only the political elite have access. In Cuba, bloggers must upload from foreign embassies or hotels to get an unfiltered connection. China's 642 million internet users face what's called the Great Firewall, which blocks dissenting sites and social media. Ratch says the report's publication lets journalists and citizens in these countries know the world is watching and cares. Daniela Schreier, VOA News, New York.
And before we go, the U.S. Justice Department says it is investigating the death of an African-American man who died after suffering spinal injuries while in police custody in the eastern U.S. city of Baltimore. The investigation will look for civil rights violations in the case of Freddie Gray, who was arrested on April 12th. Well, that's it for International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Michael Lippin. If you'd like to reach me on Twitter, I'm at Michael_Lippin, spelled L-I-P-I-N.
I'm Jim Stevenson with Business News on VOA Global. U.S. stocks were a mixed bag Tuesday, with the Dow ending lower after a handful of uninspiring earnings reports, while the Nasdaq closed near a record high following a proposed biotech merger. Travelers, DuPont, and IBM shares weighed on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. DuPont reported lower sales in all of its businesses and said a strong dollar would take a toll on its full-year earnings. IBM also mentioned currency effects when it reported a fall in revenue late Monday. The dollar has gained almost 9% since the beginning of the year against a basket of major currencies, and that's hurting companies with large overseas operations. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 85 points to finish at 17,949. The S&P 500 shedding 3 points to sit at 20,097. And the Nasdaq Composite added 19 points to close at 50,014. Mexico has become the most attractive place in North America to build new automobile factories, a shift that has siphoned jobs from the United States and Canada, yet helped to keep car and truck prices in check for consumers. In the past 2 years, eight automakers have opened or announced new plants or expansions in Mexico. Just last week, Toyota announced a new plant to build a popular Corolla. And now, with work done in Canada, Ford unveiled plans for Mexican engine and transmission factories. Low labor costs and fewer tariffs are also the swing factors, and Mexico trumps the United States on free trade. It has agreements with 45 countries, meaning low tariffs for exporting globally. Greek local authorities were on the brink of revolt Tuesday against the central government's move to use cash reserves from state agencies, including hospitals and kindergartens, to help the country make ends meet. That's a look at business news from VOA. Diabetes seems to be affecting an ever-growing number of people here in the United States, elsewhere in the world as well. On today's edition of Now, David Byrd takes us to Sweden, where a new study sheds new hope and opportunities for treatment. But first, in the American Cafe with Ira Melman, we hear about advancements in cancer research and treatment, which have made great strides in recent years, and there's more to report on, as we hear right now.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Scientists and educators in the United States and China say it pays to introduce very young children to new technologies, from computer programming to designing electronic circuits. With the right approach, they say, children learn not to be intimidated by abstract thinking. VOA's George Pudich is in the cafe with the story.
And now you can paint your back.
Even before they learn to read and write, children can manipulate images. Tablet computers with touch-sensitive screens are ideal for lining up simple commands, which is exactly what programming is all about, says Mitchell Resnick, co-developer of a code learning program called Scratch Junior.
Each block tells the characters what to do. You snap the blocks together, and you've made a computer program.
7-year-old Talia Levitt is having a good time.
It's pretty fun because you can do like almost anything on it. Yeah.
It is up to parents to decide how much time their children spend exposed to modern technology. But as Sandra Calvert, director of Children's Digital Media Center at Georgetown University, notes, it's all around us.
We live in the digital age, and just as it's a worry that there may be too much screen time, there's also a concern that our children will be left behind if they don't know how to use the technologies that are going to shape 21st century careers, jobs, and how we are going to succeed as a nation.
At so-called maker spaces in Beijing, children between 4 and 15 also use tools and machines such as 3D printers to create various projects. They are part of the so-called maker movement that started in the U.S. but quickly spread to other countries, connecting people who like to make things with their hands. One of the movement's pioneers, Wang Shenglin, says that trend appeals to the younger generation.
The old generation, it's like, we go to work, but the young generation, we see them, they start trying. They're trying so hard, actually, to do what they love. And that's the difference.
It goes against tradition in China not to follow the crowd, but young entrepreneurs like 24-year-old Huang Weiji want to change things.
Our generation thinks that we really need to do something we like in order to innovate. To us, we are as capable as foreigners. Why can they do something and we cannot?
Huang says Chinese will have to learn that although opening a private business includes the possibility of failure, his generation will have wider experience of the world, so they will be prepared to make mistakes and learn from them. George Pudich, VOA News, Washington.
There is a new way of killing certain cancer tumors that allow the patient to go home on the same day. Surgeons at the Keck Medical Center of the University of Southern California became the first doctors to use this procedure on a patient with the help of high-intensity focused ultrasound, or HIFU, and new robotic technology. Elizabeth Lee reports from Los Angeles.
Dr. Inderbir Gill says the process starts with an incision about a centimeter wide.
A robotic device then gets into the abdomen, finds the tumor, and kills it.
So that's what's exciting about the case today is that, to our knowledge, for the first time, a kidney tumor has been ablated using high-intensity focused ultrasound as monotherapy without any additional treatment. And allowing us to do this cuts down on the operative time, decreases the blood loss, decreases the chances of complications, preserves kidney function while killing the tumor, and allows the patient to go home the same day.
Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Come on in and sit a spell every day at voanews.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. Diabetes affects about 26 million people in the United States. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that by 2050, one in three Americans could have the disease. Of those with diabetes, about 5% have so-called type 1 or juvenile diabetes. The autoimmune disease often appears in early childhood and causes the pancreas not to produce enough insulin to control blood sugar. The consequences can be devastating. But now, through a joint study involving universities in Sweden, Germany, Finland, and the United States, researchers have come up with a new way of looking at the blood that makes it possible to detect the disease and start treatment earlier. Uka Lernmark is a lead researcher at Sweden's Lund University. He is also part of the so-called TEDI program. TEDI stands for the Environmental Determinants of Diabetes in the Young.
So the TEDI study has discovered that the appearance of autoantibodies against insulin-producing cells appear during the first years of life. But the disease is not diagnosed until some 10 years later.
Lernmark says that the study gives scientists the ability to look for what triggers diabetes and speeds up the time to diagnose the disease.
We now know where to look for the trigger. So we have to explain why these autoantibodies develop. And now we know that we should look during the first years of life.
The TEDI study was funded by the U.S. National Institutes of Health. It involved 8,600 children who have an increased hereditary risk of type 1 diabetes. The study has revealed triggers in children at a much earlier age than was possible before. Lernmark says that he would like to test all Swedish children at age 4.
For the first time, it will allow the researchers to look, to study the mechanisms that trigger this disease, because in the past we didn't know when to look.
The discovery could help doctors treat children earlier and use lower doses of insulin. It could even help patients to postpone or avoid symptoms as the disease develops. Fredrik Niklasson has a son and two daughters who have been part of the TEDI study in Sweden. He keeps regular and detailed diaries of what his kids eat, and they have to give blood and other body tissue samples. But Niklasson says they don't mind the regular checks because it doesn't feel much like a hospital visit.
Well, I think they think it's quite fun most of the time because it also involves some blood sampling. But in our family, that's been not a big issue.
Doctors still don't know what triggers the immune system to start attacking the pancreas's insulin-producing cells. Lernmark says that one theory is a viral infection. He says his hope is that a vaccine could be developed that would stop the original problem before the immune system kicks in.
So let's assume or hypothesize that there is a virus being responsible to trigger these islet autoantibodies. The goal is, of course, then to make a vaccine against that virus And if that would be the discovery, then the chances to prevent type 1 diabetes altogether is very high.
To learn more about the TEDDY study, log on to www.teddy, that's T-E-D-D-Y, .epi.usf.edu. And let us know your opinion on this story or anything you hear on our program by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And you can email us at voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
An Ohio State House banner marking the 150th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's death misquotes him. It says, "With malice to no one, with charity for all." Lincoln, in his second inaugural address, actually said, "With malice toward none, with charity for all." The mistake was intentional. Officials wanted the banner to be historically faithful to the one that was hung in 1865 that also misquoted Lincoln, as scores of people came to the State House to pay their respects to the slain president. It's time for sports on The Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson. After leading the Atlanta Hawks to the top seed in the Eastern Conference of the National Basketball Association playoffs and coming off of a tumultuous summer, Mike Budenholzer has beaten out Golden State's Steve Kerr for NBA Coach of the Year. Budenholzer is in his second year as head coach. He was honored after the Hawks went 60-22 during the regular season. That's the best mark in franchise history. They won their first division title since 1994, which was also the last time they held a number one seed in the playoffs. Budenholzer received 67 first place votes and 513 points overall in national balloting by sports writers and broadcasters. Kerr guided the Warriors to an NBA best 67 wins against 15 losses. In his first season as coach, he received 56 first place votes and 471 points, both pretty darn good team leaders. Cincinnati Reds manager Brian Price is a team leader, but he had a few choice words for reporters, and now he has apologized for using profanity during a pregame meeting with those reporters, but he says he stands by his message that the media should not report developments that he feels would put his team at a competitive disadvantage. Price had a profanity-filled monologue before a 6-1 victory over the Brewers on Monday. The struggling Reds had been swept in St. Louis just before that. Through the team's Twitter account on Tuesday, Price said his language was wholly inappropriate. He only cursed 77 times during that tirade, but he says he was not backing away from the intent of his message. Former Navy man Mitch Harris has made it to the major leagues in baseball, ready to join the St. Louis Cardinals bullpen. The 29-year-old pitcher is a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy. The Hall of Fame says it believes the only Naval Academy graduate to appear in the major leagues was pitcher Nemo Gaines. That was all the way back in 1921 for the Washington Senators. Harris is a 2008 Naval Academy graduate who had the rank of second lieutenant. He was selected by the Cardinals on the 13th round of the 2008 amateur draft and started his professional career in baseball in 2013. Good luck. That's a look at sports. I'm Jim Stevenson.
Whether it's superstar Ariana Grande or an older rocker like former Beatle Ringo Starr or the country western hit band Lady Antebellum, being out on tour is how you pay the bills. And venues are popping worldwide right now with numerous artists on the road making money. There was a time when musical artists made their money from album sales and they toured largely to promote those albums. Well, that's all shifted since the advent of music downloads, which provide smaller amounts of income for the artist. Now it's the tour that counts, like Grande's current sold-out performances all over the world. At 21, Ariana Grande, who got her start on Broadway and TV's Nickelodeon, is just about as hot as a hit artist can be. Remember the Beatles drummer Ringo Starr?
What's my name?
Ringo!
What's my name?
Just in case anybody forgot.
Well, at 74, Ringo's out on the road singing new songs and, of course, some old favorites like It Don't Come Easy. Like other legends of music, Ringo Starr stays ever so busy out on the road performing before packed houses. In the world of country western music, no band has Lady Antebellum beat.
Spinning faster into a new disaster. So higher unto you, baby. When it all starts coming undone, baby, you're the only one I run to. I run to you.
Antebellum got started in the capital of country music, Nashville, in 2006. And like Ariana Grande and Ringo Starr, they have tons of music industry awards on top of an already very excited bunch of fans who follow them out on the road on tour. That's music on VOA Global. I'm Steve Norman.
Well, through the ages, so many things that have happened in New York City for the very first time have gone on to become, well, a normal part of life in the rest of the world, and this may, do the same. A judge in Manhattan is granting a woman permission to serve her husband divorce papers through a Facebook message. New York State Supreme Court Justice Matthew Cooper is agreeing to the move because the plaintiff, Eleanor Arthur Baidu, is not able to reach her husband, Victor Sena Bludrasekou, via typical legal methods. Yahoo's finances Aaron Task says he believes the idea that a judge would actually allow this points to how important social media has now become. He says it goes to show Facebook is the public square now. The New York Daily News reports they hired a private detective to try to find this guy, and the only place they could find him was on Facebook. He says that's pretty powerful, and the judge apparently recognized that in his ruling as well. Task goes on to say, in this age of technological enlightenment, what is for the moment unorthodox and unusual stands a good chance of sooner or later being accepted and standard, or even outdated and passé one day. And because legislatures have often been slow to react to changes, it has fallen on the courts to ensure that our legal procedures keep pace with current technology. Very interesting development. Well, now that you can serve divorce papers on Facebook, we think a better use is just to stop by our page, VOA Asia, on Facebook, right after this program, which is now concluding. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling, and our managing editor Diane Gao. I'm Jim Stevenson. We invite you to come right back here again tomorrow for another edition of VOA Global.